Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. When it comes to writing legal thrillers, Scott Turow is the best in the business. The lawyer novelist has penned bestsellers like Presumed Innocent, Burden of Proof, and Personal Injuries. His latest novel is titled Identical, and while there are lawyers and an unsolved murder at its core, this is a story about family and sacrifice, in particular, the almost mystical connection that binds together identical twins. It's a great pleasure to welcome Scott Turow to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, Joe, thank you for making time for me.
A delight to have you here. It's something that you mentioned and I find fascinating, that your own personal story led into this fascination, if you will, about twins.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, after I finished my last novel, Innocent, I was starting to noodle around with the idea that I wanted to write about a politician who was a good guy, and I wasn't getting a long way with that idea. And somebody mentioned to me that friends' kids had identical twins, and immediately I thought, identical twins. Yeah, I've always wanted to write about identical twins. So I did a lot of work, and about 2 months along, I'm like, oh, twins, yeah. And my sister had been a twin. And the second baby did not come home from the hospital, which seemed really strange to me at a little less than 3 years old, because my father was an OBGYN. And he got everybody else's babies home healthy. It created a kind of omen for me. And, you know, he was the baby that was lost was a boy. And I was a boy and, you know, was he my twin? And, so I've always noodled with the idea of having a twin and what it would be like. And, you know, clearly once I hit on that, then the novel was off and on its way.
And there is also, as should be pointed out, that you are also following a Greek myth as well.
I am. Once I got this idea about identical twins, I remembered the Greek myth of Castor and Pollux. And that may sound more obscure than it needs to be, because Castor and Pollux are the Gemini. And so the constellation Gemini is actually named for Castor and Pollux, and Castor and Pollux are up in the sky every night, so they're not obscure figures. In the myth, although they are identical in every way, there's one difference. Pollux is immortal, and Castor is not, and that notion propelled me into what I hope is the ultimate twist into an identical. And once I had that idea, you know, I was off to the races.
Mm-hmm.
So I then figured, okay, well, let's take the plot very loosely, or really the characters, from the Greek myth. So, you know, there's Zeus, there's Leda in the myth, who's the queen of Sparta. You know, there's Castor, there's Pollux, Tiresias, and all of these figures become characters in the novel in a, you know, modern-day Greek community. And, you know, but I don't follow the myth slavishly, although anybody who goes back and reacquaints themselves with the myth will see some of the action coming.
So the brothers are Paul and Cass Giannis,
mm-hmm.
And Paul is a politician. He's running for mayor.
Yeah.
And his brother is just getting out of prison for the murder of his
girlfriend.
Yes.
25 years before. And the brother of the murder victim, a kind of eccentric billionaire, accuses Paul, the mayoral candidate, of also having had a hand in the murder. And this accusation, which he broadcasts literally, you know, loud and wide, propels a suit for libel, which takes us into the courtroom, and also sends my, you know, two-person Greek chorus, the two investigators, onto the pursuit of the clues in a 25-year-old murder case that's basically being reinvestigated now.
When you get past the when you get past the myth and setting it up and thinking about twins and doing the very real work of thinking about the novel,
right?
Once you get into that courtroom, is that more comfortable, or is it still as much work? You still have to think it through.
No, you're. I mean, I have to think about it, but there's not. There's not a lot of mysteries to me about what the judge would be saying.
And,
you know, the complexities of the courtroom relationships, there are always personal elements involved in real life. And, of course, that's true in Kendall County, the site of all of my novels. But, no, there is no question that I am most at home in the courtroom, and I find the actions of all the characters most predictable in that setting.
So getting to that point has to be a lot of fun, very freeing.
Right, right.
And there's a lot of science in this book as well.
Yeah. So you take a crime that's 25 years old, and there was no such thing as DNA before 1984, and the crime took place in the novel in 1983. So this then unknown science is applied to the new case, and the question immediately arises, can you tell the difference between the fingerprints of identical twins? Answer, yes. Can you tell the difference in the DNA of identical twins? And the answer to that today, believe it or not, is in theory, yes. And, you know, the science, you'd have to be lucky in order to actually be able to differentiate them, but the fact that it can be done in 2008 when the novel is set, the chances of doing it were about 1 in 100, probably better today, but that little chance really drives the action in the middle part of the novel.
The character of Tim Brody, he is an investigator. He was in on the original investigation, mm-hmm. the original case. Mm-hmm. And as the story unfolds, he's now 81 years old.
Right.
And he is dealing with this. And it's a fascinating look at age and the power that is there as well.
Right. Tim Brody is the character who ran away with the novel. And if you're lucky and a book is going well, there's always somebody like that who, you know, I knew if you're going to be reinvestigating a 25-year-old murder, you'd have to try to find the homicide detective who led the original investigation. That Tim would become a principal character, I did not have in mind originally. But when I started writing about him in scenes that I still love, but that were ultimately jettisoned, I just knew I was onto something. And I think in many ways, Tim is the moral center of the book. He's like a lot of people I met in law enforcement who were affirmative about human beings despite what they had witnessed, but who viewed their jobs as cops or FBI agents, as helping people be good, pointing out to them that, you know, those who transgress will be punished. But the point is not just to punish the transgressors. The point is so that everybody who follows the rules sort of understands that it's worth doing that.
He's a sharp character. And yet he's worried that he's not.
Yeah. He's 81. Things are slowing down. He's described as now having the permanently wary expression that you know, characterizes certain elderly people. And he probably is a little slower than he was. He certainly seems to me to be in very sound mind. But, you know, there's the natural slowing down that comes with age. But he is just, he's got his own quiet charisma. And he still knows how to interview somebody in a way that, you know, will set them at ease. And, you know, he makes most of the, you know, the big deductions that lead to the, you know, I hope surprising ending of Identical.
Scott Turow is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new novel is Identical. When you talk about the surprises, and it is, I think, safe to say that is what you are known for, yeah, in your fiction, and what ultimately brought so many audiences to you, what was it? I assume that's something that you stumble upon and not set out to say, okay, I'm gonna
pull the rug out from under you.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it varies from book to book. As I said, when I read The Myth of Castor and Pollux and thought about it for a few weeks, I suddenly knew what the sort of end of the myth would mean in terms of this novel, and it really propels the final revelation of the novel. As is customary in my novels, Identical contains more than one big surprise,
right,
and they feed into each other. So, you know, the ones along the way, you know, the result of the DNA testing I talked about was really borrowed from a pro bono case I handled, you know, a few years ago, where there was a very surprising result from a DNA examination, one that took us in a whole unanticipated direction. And so, that, you know, there are all kinds of elements in shaping the plot. I thought that Identical asks how much of what we want to believe about other people ends up shaping our intimate relationships, whether that's with our lovers or our parents or even our political leaders, that, you know, people believe what they want to believe, and, you know, our own personal mythologies are both part and parcel of our love relationships, but often an obstacle in them.
When you think about the stories that you write, given that now we somewhat expect that ending, does, after Presumed Innocent, did that make it more difficult?
No, because when I go back to the novels that went unpublished before Presumed Innocent, you know, there were surprise endings in those books too, and big twists. Like I was a writing fellow at Stanford and then taught there for a while. I spent 4 years writing a novel that ultimately, in a weird way, drove me to law school because it had a lot of legal doctrine in it. But there was a big revelation at the end of that book. So I can't remember whether it was Hemingway quoting Graham Greene or Graham Greene quoting Hemingway, that all writers write basically one book. And the notion that the world is not what it seems, that it contains unanticipated surprises, is really something we all experience, but it seems to be really important to me as a writer, and you know, that happens in all the novels. But my point is, I do that naturally. I'm not trying to satisfy commercial expectations any more than I wrote about the law in the hopes that it would be, you know, would inspire this spate of, you know, so-called legal thrillers. I am who I am. I write about what I want to write about, and I have my own compulsions as a person and as a writer, and they just manifest themselves every time.
certainly, as you mentioned a moment ago, we all have those times in our life where things shock us and surprise us. Although going back to, you were saying you had a recent pro bono case that you were working on, mm-hmm. and received this, do you see it almost magnified as a lawyer and in cases that you're constantly surprised by things?
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I was a prosecutor, I was trying one of the first PCP cases. And I don't think we hear as much about PCP anymore, but it was kind of a plague drug for a while. And, you know, the main witness was a young college student who was testifying against a lot of the guys he had gone to high school with. And the expert chemist came in and said to me, the quantities that this young boy, my main witness, had ordered of constituent chemicals would have made many, many more batches of PCP than he was going to testify about. And I realized at that point that the main witness, not only had he put it on his friends and claimed that he just bought some chemicals from them, but in point of fact, he'd been mixing drugs for months, if not years, and really was the ringleader. And that was quite a moment in my office when this really seemingly sweet young man had to be confronted with that very nasty truth. And, you know, he'd been on his way to medical school, but I don't think he got there after that.
It's important for you to still practice law.
Well, I went to law school rather than continue my career as a college English teacher. And I realized that it jeopardized my ambition to be a writer. But I did it because, for two reasons. One, I was driving myself crazy as a writer, sort of trying to feast on myself and will myself to greatness. And my grandfather, a Russian immigrant, once said to me, Scotty, what kind of life is this? Locked up all day in a room with a pencil. And there was a lot of wisdom in what my grandfather had said to me. So that was one thing. But the other thing that drove me was this sort of innate fascination with the law. And that still maintains itself. I'll still hear about court decisions and go, God, I wonder, how did they get to that point? What was the reasoning? How does that tie up with the rest of our legal tradition? So when presumed innocent happened to me, and it's, you know, the kind of blessing every writer ought to experience, you know, I decided, why would I quit practicing law if, in point of fact, I'd been able to write presumed innocent while doing it? And part of it was the fear of committing myself again to the life locked up with a pencil. But a lot of it was my belief that, you know, I had been freed in a way to do the good things lawyers can do. And so I changed my practice. I practiced less, and I did a lot more pro bono work, all with the blessings of my law partners, I must say. You know, I've been able to do things that I'm proud of in the pro bono realm and still represent paying clients for, you know, at times. I tried a case a couple of years ago. Again, the state had charged a doctor with what I thought was a non-existent crime. And, you know, he walked out of the courtroom a free man after trial. And that's a neat feeling. That's still a really neat feeling to represent somebody you know is innocent. And it doesn't happen all that often in the criminal justice system if it's working the way it's supposed to. So, you know, you'll have to forgive me for saying this. I like lawyers. Most Americans don't like lawyers. At least they don't like the other person's lawyer. But I enjoy the company of lawyers.
on that list of people that we have misgivings, I think journalists also fall into that
Well. Oh, yes.
And we so often, on this program, I talk to many, many journalists who become novelists, and we often explore how being the mechanics of being a journalist makes you a better novelist. The mechanics of being an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
How does that help in writing a novel?
Well, as I mentioned, after college, I went out to Stanford, and I was a writing fellow there and then a teacher. And at that point, a lot of the faculty at Stanford, certainly the faculty at Amherst, where I'd been an undergraduate, were gripped by the basic modernist assumption, which is that art leads culture, and therefore innovative art, even if it can't be, as Ezra Pound put it, even if it can't be understood by the bullet-headed many, you know, that was good in and of itself. I found that confounding, but I couldn't quite figure this out for myself until I became a lawyer and started trying cases. And I realized that there was a lot in common between writing a novel and trying a case. You've got, you know, different voices, different characters. There are characters in your novel and witnesses in the trial. When you're a prosecutor, especially, you have got to be telling a jury a believable story about how something evil happened. But you can't do it in a way that the bullet-headed many won't understand. Because you lose the case that way. The bullet-headed many are the 12 people sitting in the jury box. And it taught me to respect a popular audience and to ask what are the themes that grip all of us. And certainly crime is one of them. And it just made me a much better storyteller to think about the trial lawyer's task. I never set out to become a best-selling author. I was shocked when it happened. But I did have as a goal, as I once pronounced it to one of my faculty colleagues at Stanford, who was absolutely stunned when I said it, I think a really great novel should be able to be read, not only by an English professor, but also by a bus driver. Mm. And that still today seems to me a worthy goal for, you know, really great fiction.
And it's much of what you're doing in a courtroom, right? Of
absolutely.
Telling that story to the average man.
Right. You've got a jury,
and woman on the
could
jury.
Be, you know, a construction laborer, a woman at home with her kids, somebody who runs a hair salon, an actuary, an English professor. A full cross-section of society. And you've got to be able to talk to all of them and make them understand the story that you're trying to portray.
The new novel is Identical. It is published by Grand Central. Scott Turow, a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Oh, Joe, thank you.
Joining us.
A joy to be here.
Thank you so much for being with us on this week's Book Show. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. This show was recorded at Argo Studios in New York City. My thanks to their team. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for the Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.